So 5G4D has been going for nearly 5 years now, and I'm sure many of you will have missed some of the early interviews because you weren't there at the beginning. I mean, why would you have been? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to release some classic episodes from some legends of the industry that you might have missed. And so I hope you enjoy these shows, and I hope you enjoy the brand new ones that come out every 2 weeks. So thank you for listening, and enjoy.
Out of the street corners they scream. You knew it was coming. You've been waiting for this for months. Rumor hardened into fear, and now they scream at you. The sirens, their hysterical wail tearing through the white noise of the city. And you run. You run to pick up those things that can never be replaced. A picture of them in the days when they still loved you. Your mother's wedding ring. And then you turn to your shelf of games. You only have room for five. Five games for Doomsday. Five Games for Doomsday is a show in which board game personalities are thrust into a cabin in the woods to outrun an oncoming disaster, but can only take five of their games with them. But which will they choose?
My guest this week is the undisputed king of board game media. He's gone from being a math teacher and a pastor to running the biggest board game media company in the world, and is the name on everybody's lips when they think board game reviewer. On top of that, he's the executive director and founder of the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund, a charity whose purpose it is to help gamers in need. My guest this week is Tom Vassell. Tom, welcome to the cabin.
Well, I appreciate that. I might argue... I would argue about this king media empire type thing that makes me sound. I talk a lot about board games, but I don't consider myself to be the king at all.
Well, I'm sure there's lots of people who would. So I guess my first question is, how difficult was it for you to pick the five games to take to the cabin?
I love making lists, so that part isn't hard at all. I've actually refused to answer this question. You're the first person I've ever done this for in the past, because anytime someone says, you know, what games would you take to a desert island or whatever, I always say, go look at my top 10 games. And I thought, all right, I'll do this a little bit different. These aren't necessarily my top games. These are games that I would want to have me for a variety of reasons. So to that end, I like doing it because I love making lists. I love all the time I make lists of stuff just because it's fun for me.
And sort of what was the criteria that you set for choosing the games? Is it just pure utility, or are some of them sentimental choices?
Well, it's both. I mean, obviously, I want a game that I can play over and over and over and over and over and over again with lots of people. But also, I want games that remind me of all the good things that have happened in my life. I've had a very wonderful life, and I want to remember some of that stuff.
And, you know, if anyone has watched a review of yours, it's clear you're not someone who necessarily cares about keeping the components of a game pristine. But are you someone who's values your game collection, or would you not be bothered if all the games just went up in flames?
Well, let me go back to that thing. I actually do care about the components. If you check the Dice Tower Library, you'll find that I take great care of them. I put them in nice containers. I make that library look as amazing as I possibly can. But at the end of the day, I also realize that these are just pieces. And like, I'll drop my components on the table in my reviews. People get upset about it. And I'm thinking, really? So you do roll dice, right? You throw dice on the table. It's the same thing. I'm just doing it with about 50 dice at the same time. You might lay a card on the table. I'm just laying 100 cards on the table. It's the same thing. That being said, I would be slightly sad to see my game collection go, although I wouldn't care one whit about games if the apocalypse is happening. But I would be sad to see my collection go for any reason, but I would get over it pretty quickly because they're toys. You know, in my life, I want my wife, my kids, my friends. And even after that, it would be pictures. It would be my computer, I would probably save over board games. There's so many things. Board games are board games. And we've talked about this already. You know, what would happen if the Dice Tower collection went up in flames? We're talking about this right now because we're putting insurance on it. You know, what would happen if something happened to it? And I'd be like, oh, man, what a pain. I'm sad. But it's also stuff. It's stuff. I don't care that much about any stuff.
So I want to go back now to the beginning. So for someone, you seem like someone who has games in your blood. Did you grow up in a very gamery household?
Well, my mom was the main gamer. She played party games. She really liked party games. And my dad did too, but I'm going to have to assume it was my mom because my mom's passed away. My dad does not play games as much. He played, you know, we just recently played some games with him and he's there. He's a good sport about the whole thing, but I think it was my mom. And so she kind of pushed it on us. We didn't have a TV growing up. So I really, you know, we played board games a lot as a family. And I just, other kids in the neighborhood had video game systems and I loved video games and I played them, but I wanted my own thing. So I picked board games.
And so, you know, you're someone who's not backwards in, you know, saying that you're a person of faith and talking about having faith. How religious was your household that you grew up in? Was it a very religious household?
Oh, very extreme. I mean, my dad's not that way nowadays as much, so although pretty close still. But I grew up in a very, very conservative, very much strong, independent, fundamental, Bible-believing household, not having a TV. They were anti Dungeons and Dragons, you know, so that affected that to some degree. I wasn't necessarily a rebel. I didn't like everything my parents did, although, you know, that's how parents and kids work, you know, I think to some degree, but, yeah, so I just, board gaming was something that was legit, except Dungeons and Dragons, of course.
And so, you know, you said that you grew up, you know, in a very conservative household. Are you softer? Are you less conservative than your parents were?
Well, if I wasn't softer, I wouldn't talk about some of this stuff on the show, right? Yeah, of course I am. I think all kids tend to move in one direction from their parents. Although, you know, so obviously some kids get stricter than their parents. I want to be clear. I'm thrilled about my childhood. I'm very fortunate. I had a mother and a father. They took care of us. We sometimes barely survived money-wise, but we survived. I never went hungry. I had a roof over my head. My parents loved me. So I'm thankful for that. I don't agree with them on everything, but as someone with adult children now, I find that they do not agree with me on everything. So that's just how life works. I definitely was seduced by fantasy games. I was like, I can't play Dungeons and Dragons. Why not? It seems super interesting.
So you talked in your notes about Avalon Hill games. And, you know, it's very interesting to talk about those. They seem to have a really high barrier to entry. Do you think back then to get into gaming, you had to be really sort of willing to read complicated rule books?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's the case. You know, yes, you could play simple games, like Scotland Yard is an example of that, or Stratego or things like that. But for the most part, I mean, don't get me wrong, Monopoly is fairly complex if you think about it. It's just that game's in the zeitgeist and people pass on the rules to that from parent to child for whatever reason. But yeah, if you wanted to play these Avalon Hill games, the reason my neighbor friend had never played these games because the rule book, but I sat there and I was like, I will learn the rules for these. I had another neighbor friend who had Access and Allies and he came and taught it to us. And I thought, man, you know, this game's good, but it seems like there's things missing from it. So I grabbed the rule book and read it. And I was like, wait a minute, we're playing this wrong, this wrong, this wrong, this wrong. He was extremely annoyed at me. We had a big argument over the rules. And I was like, the rule book says this. He made an incredibly rude gesture at me. I'll never forget it. And at that time I knew righteously that I was in the right. I was following the rule book. My dad would constantly pull me aside and say, look, the other kids aren't going to like you if you're always insistent on following the rules. Cause I would always scream about rules and in sports games or, you know, these are the rules of tag. This is how tag is supposed to work. You know, follow the rule book. But it would fascinate me. I would read the rule books and I would just get them. I would say, well, wait a minute. The rule book says this. This is how the rules are supposed to work. We played the games that way. And I'd be like, the game is so much more fun when we play by the rules. And that whole thing where everyone plays Monopoly wrong, I was ahead of the curve there. I read the rules and like, wait a minute, there's nothing about free parking here.
I mean, do you think Monopoly works as a game if you play by the rules?
No, I have, you know, and I know, you know, Monopoly is one of those roller coasters, right? Everyone hates Monopoly. If you're a gamer, like, oh, it's hate Monopoly. Then it's like, okay, everyone hates Monopoly, so I'm going to say Monopoly's not that bad. And then, you know, then someone says, no, it really is that bad. And that's kind of where I'm at. You know, I was like, oh, yeah, Monopoly's terrible. We have all these new Euro games. Okay, wait a minute. Maybe Monopoly gets a bad rap. I played it. Nope. It's bad. There's some good things in it, and I'm not going to discount the effect it's had on humanity as a whole. But at the end of the day, it is random. Yes, I know you can argue that you can trade with other people, but if you play a game with me, I'm not going to trade you the complete sets that you need unless you give me a complete set back. And if that doesn't happen, then we're going to sit there and someone's going to randomly win.
So on the subject of Eurogames, then, your first game is a classic in the genre, and this is Le Havre. So why are you taking this to the cabin?
Well, it's currently my favorite game. So, I mean, that's why. This one also is a game that has a good deal of replayability, which is something I'll mention a little bit more in the future. But I just really enjoy this game. I feel like it's a long, meaty style Euro game. I want to have different kinds of games to play. And there's a lot of these games that come out now, you know, several dozen a year at this point. But this is one that I just really enjoy.
And so I was watching the other day, preparing for this show, the top 10 lists. And this came up as number one. And you sort of turned to the camera and you said, you see, I do like Euro games. You get this reputation of not being a fan of Euro games. Where does that come from, do you think?
I believe it comes from people who are big fans of any game will insist that someone who does not like it as much as them is just not part of that genre. So this happens with anything. Magic the Gathering. If I come and play Magic the Gathering, unless I'm really into it, then I don't know what I'm talking about. I've just noticed this recently where I gave some mild criticism of Eon's End, a deck building game. And the people who really love Eon's End kind of showed up in droves like, what? You don't know what you're talking about. And I think this is actually something that's bad for the hobby, is this idea where I think I'm better than you because I know more games than you. And when I say this, folks, I am also including myself in this because I've done this myself. Where someone, I'll meet someone and they'll be like, oh, I like these games too. I like Munchkin. And in my head, I think, poor deluded fool. But they're not a poor deluded fool because that's what they like. And I'm not better than them because my games are better. And so, yes, I have the reputation of not liking some heavy Euro games because there are a few that I've definitely skewered and said I don't like these. And I'll call a game out if I think it's themeless and such. And I do tend to be an omni-gamer and like everything. And if you like everything, then you don't please anybody, I found, you know. So that's just the way it goes.
And so, you know, when I got into gaming, this was around sort of 2011, 2012, and you know, Uwe Rosenberg was the name they talked about back then. How important do you think he is to the world of game design?
Oh, he's important. It's really interesting that he's had an effect on gaming twice, really. Like, his initial effect was Bonanza. People forget about that. Bonanza was a pretty huge game when it came out. And he made lots of little small card games like Bonanza that were very popular. And then Agricola changed the hobby in many different ways. It made these big, giant, complex games, but with a strong sense of variety to them. That's one way that Agricola changed hobby. The other way is with Zev bringing it into America as a pre-order. It would have been a Kickstarter had Kickstarter been around back then. You know, he brought this in as a pre-order, and that was the doorway where now any major game is in English. But back then, it was not necessarily the case. But that had nothing to do with Uwe, but it was his game that opened that door. And his games just give you a plethora of options, just like a pile of options. A lot of people have copied his style for sure. And he jumps from one thing to another and then just kind of really delves into that. So he did the card games for a while. Then he did these big, heavy Euros. Now he's on this polyomino kick, you know, making all these games with different Tetris-shaped pieces. And I don't know where he'll move to next, but he's definitely influential.
And so what does Le Havre do that his other games don't? Why is this the Uwe Rosenberg game that is your favorite game?
I am pretty happy with Le Havre because my thinking on it's always the same, in the sense that I like games that give you lots of good options, and that's what Le Havre does. It gives you so many good options. I never feel like I'm taking a bad option. I'm just taking something that's not as good as something else. No matter what I do, it feels good. I'm like constantly building and seeing good things happen, good things happen, good things happen. And I'm like, hey, look what I've done, to the point that even if I've lost, I still feel pretty good and had a great time playing the game. And that's somewhat diametrically opposed to things like Agricola, where sometimes at points in the game, I'm like, I'm going to die, a horrible beggar, starving death. And well, that's, you know, still can be fun. For me, the plethora of goodness is what I like better.
So I want to talk now about sort of your life before the Dice Tower. So you did a degree in biblical studies. Now, this may sound like a stupid question, but what is the structure of that course? What do you learn in a degree of biblical studies?
Well, I mean, without being too trite, there's a lot of biblical studies. There's a lot of different things, sections of the Bible that one would study. So there's a lot of things like that. There's also practicality classes, you know, how to I took a lot of public speaking classes, or how to preach, how to outline. I took some business classes, you know, but it was mostly just actual biblical studies. They would take different sections of the Bible and go into depth with that. And then I took a lot of basic classes, obviously, to fill out, you know, English, math, all that jazz.
And sort of you went to a Christian college. So what is the focus on the study of the Bible? Is it to try and get God's purpose? And do you study the different analyses of the Bible that have happened through history?
Well, I think it's so that you don't – it's to better prepare you, as with anything, right? I've come to the conclusion after going through – my undergraduate course, that undergraduate courses in general are more basic than you think. Like in high school, you think college is it. After college, you're like, did I learn much? You know, it's when I started taking my master's classes, I was like, oh, wow, this is learning. You know, this is really in depth. And that's what it is. I mean, I think college, at the end of the day, I don't know that I'm sending my kids to college for any other reason than to A, get a degree, and B, help them focus. Because so much of what's taught in college is still fairly basic level. You know, I often say, what did I use? What do I use today from my undergraduate learning? And it's not much.
And so you ended up in Korea. How did you end up there? And how was the sort of culture shock when you arrived?
It is a very long story. So I'm just going to condense it down to that. It was a series of events that led me to Korea. I said I would not go. The culture shock was certainly there, although I always joke, half joke, that me as a Yankee growing up in Pennsylvania, moving to Pensacola, Florida, which is basically part of Alabama, not Florida, was a bigger culture shock than going to Korea. The North and the South of the USA are very different places. In the North, people tell you exactly what they think, good or bad. In the South, they tell you good, but they may not mean it. And they hug a lot, and I wasn't prepared for that. But yeah, going to Korea was definitely a different culture. The Asians tend to be more group-oriented. You know, Americans tend to be, hey, it's me, the lone gunner, the army of one. I will do it. And Asians are more, hey, you know, we do things together. Just to clarify, like an example of that would be, I was at a game cafe, I ordered a piece of cake, you know, and they bring me a piece of cake with six forks because there were six people at the table. And I thought, oh, I'm not sharing this cake with any of these people. It's my cake, you know, but that's not how that works. You don't do things by yourself per se. It's a group effort. And there's good and bad in both philosophies, obviously, but I got used to it, right? I got used to that sort of group mentality, and there's a lot of goodness in it.
And you worked as a pastor in Korea. How hard was it for you to get up on stage in front of people? Or are you a natural at that?
Yeah, well, that's one thing. I don't know. It's just always been very innate in me. That's one thing that does not often make me nervous. I remember when I was in school in third grade and we had to get up and do something similar, all the boys in the class. And my dad said he came in and said he was so proud that I was the only person who did even remotely a decent job. Now, yes, he's my dad and he says things like that, but my dad barely says things like that. So I just like that ever since a kid, like, oh, I can give a speech here. I'm on it. I can talk in front of people. I love it. And actually the more people, the more confident I am. If I had to speak in front of 10,000 people, I'm very, very confident. You want to have a one-on-one session with me? Do we have to? You know, I'm not so keen on that. So, I mean, yes, the first time I spoke with a translator, I was super nervous. The first time you do some things, you're just nervous in general. But I was nervous at my wedding. But mostly when I get up in front of people, I don't know what it is. It doesn't bother me at all.
And so do you think that grounding in sort of performance and speaking to people, trying to clarify things, contributed to this current career that you have? Did it help you becoming a sort of YouTuber?
I think that mixed with my ability to just speak about whatever. I'm trying to think of the polite term for it. I know the impolite term for it. But just to the gift of just speaking about whatever, just to go, and just talk about nonsense, but try to make it as interesting as I possibly can. And I found that I'm decent at doing that. You know, I can talk about a very mundane thing and try to make it as interesting as I possibly can. And obviously not everyone likes my style, but a lot of people do. And I tend to I poke fun at myself, which I found people tend to like. And, you know, just poke fun at the mild things I find in life. Also, I'm incredibly opinionated. So that I found helps a lot too. Like I will make really strong opinions about everything. Here's my top 10 list on this. And I really like this. And I really didn't like that. My wife says it can be off-putting in person. But I found that when you make videos, people tend to like those strong opinions or not like them. But either way, they come back for more.
And so, you know, YouTube is famous for people. When you make a statement of opinion, people come back at you in the comments. Have you developed a sort of thick hide when it comes to people criticizing you on YouTube? Or did you always have that?
I've had a thick hide my whole life. I've been made fun of ever since I've been as a kindergarten. I remember distinctly riding the bus to school and just everyone making fun of me and calling me monkey because I acted like a monkey, I guess. And I remember as a kid, I was like, okay, I'm not as strong as the other kids. I'm not as fast as the other kids. I'm terrible at sports. But I can make people laugh, even if they're laughing at me. So I'm going to take that and use that. And if that's what I am, if I'm the clown that people laugh, go for it. You know. And I kind of went through life like that. When I got to college and farther, I kind of said, hey, you know what? If someone's making fun of me, they're not making fun of somebody else. So be it. You know, that's what it is. Let me be the guy everyone makes fun of. Now, I've been burned because I have done that to other people and found that not everyone has that same kind of opinion. And that was a nice introduction to my in-laws. Yes, sometimes though, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much it rolls off your back. There are days where someone will say something or I'll read something and it just burns you. It burns me when you see stuff that is a blatant lie that gets me. You know, like if someone says, oh, Tom said this was a good game or a bad game, they must not have paid him. That sort of thing just bugs me. Something that when someone calls me a liar, it bugs me sometimes when people will criticize me for my personal beliefs and opinions or twist something. Like I remember one of our reviews, we did a review of Chaos in the Old World, which is a pretty good game. And we said so in our review, but we also said in our review, I said I didn't like the fact that the board was made of human skin. And lo and behold, Tom, he let that color his whole review. And, you know, he doesn't like it. And how dare he not like a board made of human skin? What a prude. What's wrong with him? Why would he not like a board made of human skin? And I'm thinking that has nothing to do with the fact that of my Christian upbringing. It just has to do with the fact that I personally found that to be a bit grotesque. And I'm surprised that other people come down on me so hard because I dared say such a controversial opinion. So there are days where I'll read the comments and I'll be like, ah, I can't believe these people said this. But you know what? I get over it, you know, because it's just human nature. We tend to read the one negative comment to the 200 positive ones. And the internet is mean. I always, my general comment is, anyone who says I am my own worst critic has never read the internet, which is the truth of the matter, right? If whenever we do a video that's a bigger video, I always go to Reddit. And sometimes I'll say, guys, Reddit hasn't said anything negative about us. There's something wrong here, you know, or Twitter hasn't said anything negative. And in fact, some parts of the internet have become so toxic for me lately that I found that I just cut them out of my life. Like Twitter, I've recently cut Twitter out of my life almost completely. And I found that I'm happier for it. You know, you just cannot read everything people say about you.
So your next game then is a bona fide classic. And this is Ticket to Ride. Did you realize this game was going to become the classic it did when you first played it?
Yes, that sounds very egotistical. But I remember where we played it. We played it in a hotel room in Korea. The president of Days of Wonder happened to be traveling to China to look at the first production copy of Ticket to Ride. He stopped in Seoul on the way, invited me and one of my friends. We went to the hotel. We played it. He explained the rules. I looked at it. I was like, that's it? Because he had told me it was going to be a big game. And I was like, We played a round of it. And I was like, wait a minute. What is this game? We played it again the next couple of days, and I said, this is Spiel des Jahres. Not only is this Spiel des Jahres, this is one of the best games I've ever played. It's that good. And the more I played it, I was that impressed with it. So I haven't been always able to call them, but that one I did call. And that one I like because it plays, I can play it with anybody.
And yeah, so this game appeals to, you know, gamers who are avowedly heavy gamers and people who are new to the hobby. What is it about the game that gives it this broad appeal?
I think because I think some of it because it's just such an innocuous theme. Hey, we're connecting trains, and trains obviously have some sort of strong preference from people. There's so many train board games out there. It also taps into that Rummy-esque, you know, a lot of people like Rummy. People like collecting things, and it gives you this sense of accomplishment. And that's every good game does that. It gives you a sense of accomplishment. Even if you lose, I still connect at these roots. It can be as mean as you want it to be. It can be as light as you want it to be. It's literally has like four or five rules really to the game. And it looks pretty, I don't know. It hits that feeling like this is a game you can do well at after your first play. You probably won't do that well. If I play someone new, I'm probably going to whoop up on them. But I feel like when you play it, you feel like you could do well.
Does this game feel like a sort of primer for what people new to the hobby will discover as they go through the hobby? Does it have a lot of elements of sort of classic hobby board games?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it basically has some basic things, you know, collect as long as you want to collect and then you start playing. But if you wait too long to start playing, then you might not get everything you want, or the game might run out before you get a chance to do everything you want to. Compete for stuff, connecting routes. I don't know. I don't know that I've always called this, right, the gateway game. That's the terminology that we use. But at the same time, if this is someone's end result, if somebody is ending at Ticket to Ride, that's also fine. And the reason I would bring this one in the apocalypse, and so I thought about this, right? I'm not bringing necessarily my top five games. Le Havre is my number one game. Ticket to Ride is not my top five games, but I would bring this because I feel like if I'm going to start the new gaming renaissance, this is the kind of game that I think I can get a lot of people to play.
So I want to talk now about you know, what you're known for, and this is the Dice Tower. So you started in the board game media world writing reviews. Why did you start?
The very first couple reviews I wrote, way back when, because someone said that someone started this game sharing service where they said they would send out a bunch of games to a game group, but everyone in that game group had to write some reviews. So I was like, all right, sounds good to me. So we got these games. We all wrote reviews. Even my wife wrote some reviews, you know, like little mini reviews of these games. That fizzled out. But it got me thinking about it. I like the idea of sharing stuff. And I had moved to Korea, and I wanted to do something, right? I mean, I walked around at night. I saw the cities and stuff. I was like, all right, but I need to do something. And I like the idea of the internet. Using the internet to do something. I had already tried to do that back when I had been playing Warhammer 40,000. Even when I played collectible card games, I started a website about Overpower, my favorite collectible card game. I started a website about that with Warhammer 40K. I started a website where I kept track of people's wins and losses in Warhammer 40K. And so I was like, all right, if I write reviews of board games, that could be something. I found this new website called Board Game Geek that seemed like a good place to put these reviews, also on the Rec Games board. That depository of all things board games, which was quite a big deal in 2002. And then I got a few of these new board games, and I said, you know what? No one else is talking about these games. I just want to tell people about these. I want to share this. And the response, which was actually fairly small, but the response was very positive. People were like, oh, yeah, good job. Thanks for telling us about these games. And I thought, all right, I found my thing. Let's do it. And I've never done anything halfway, so I just started reviewing like a madman.
And sort of what was the media scene like back then? Were there other people doing it? And sort of when you started the podcast, was this the first board game podcast?
No, so back when I first started, it was all written, right? There was a lot of written stuff before my time, from Mike Siggins on Sumu to Greg Schlosser, who wrote thousands of reviews. And I thought, well, I'll never catch up to these guys, but I'll try, you know, I'll try to catch up. And then I heard this idea of podcasting came across my thing. You know, we had started, you know, seeing that, hey, you can do things on the internet that are not just text and pictures. There's ways to listen to things. And I remember Scott Nicholson did a video for a TV thing, which I was very impressed with. And then Scott Alden started the Geek Speak, a Board Game Geek podcast, and Mark Johnson started a podcast, Board Games to Go. And in one of his podcasts, Mark Johnson said, anybody can do this. You know, if you want to do this, put your voice out there. And I thought, you know what? I don't really like to write, but I love to talk. I love so much talking. I'd rather talk. And in the back of my church, there's all these microphones that I have access to. And no one's using most of the time. This will just work. So that's what I decided to do. I decided to start a podcast and see what would happen.
And so you started the podcast, and obviously it was hugely successful. Then you went onto YouTube, and that sort of became, you know, a large focus of the Dice Tower. When you look back from then to where you are now, how surprised are you by the success of the Dice Tower?
I was just in the right place at the right time. I always tell people that. Now, I mean, I took advantage of the things that were there, but I was really fortunate. I was fortunate to get into podcasting at the very beginning. And then I bought a Mac computer with a camera in it, and I thought, I like video. I like to talk. This might be easier than writing reviews. Let's see how it goes. I'll post a few of these on this new website, YouTube. I don't know if YouTube was new, but it was newer to me, right? So I'll post these up there and see what happens. And then it really took off, and I just got in on the ground floor. That's how life works, right? You get in on the ground floor. It doesn't really matter if you're talented or not.
And so, you know, you're a boss now. You're the president of the Dice Tower. And as a boss, you know, you have people under you, and you're kind of responsible for paying their wages and all of that sort of stuff. Do you feel a pressure now being president of the Dice Tower, or does it still feel like the sort of great fun knockabout producing videos thing that you've always done?
Well, no. Don't get me wrong. It's really fun, and I really like making videos. But yes, my life has changed considerably. Now, I was prepared for this because I was a pastor of a church in Korea, and there I was, the quote-unquote boss, right? So this wasn't something new to me, but my whole life I run into a problem. I'm like, well, not my problem. Let's go to the boss, you know, and that's just something I've always done. With the Dice Tower, I did it. I'm like, I'm my own. And I went off and I started the Dice Tower and went full time. And I was like, I'm my own boss. No problem. Then I hired my first employee and I was like, all right, we're partners. You know, that's how you look at it in a sense. Like, oh, I have one employee. It's not employee boss. We work together. But now I have six employees and a whole pile of contributors. And suddenly I am the boss. The buck does stop here. And yeah, I feel very much it is a lot of pressure because I'm very protective of my employees. I don't want anything bad to happen to them. I want to make sure that the Dice Tower is a success so that they are successful too. And that's just, it's just a big responsibility. You know, it is a weight. It has made me more serious for sure. But I mean, I still really like it, but it's a different dynamic.
So your next game then is Kanizia Classic, and this is Lost Cities. Now, in your notes, you said to me that you were taking it because, you know, you could play it with your wife. And in gaming, there's this phenomenon of the spouse game, the game that you sit down and play specifically with your spouse. Is Lost Cities a spouse game? And if so, why?
No, Lost Cities is the game I play with my wife. It might work for other couples, and that's fine. I'm very hesitant to do that. You know, I get a lot of people like, I'm trying to get my wife or husband or boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever to play games. What do you recommend? I'm like, I don't know. You know, I don't know them. And maybe they don't want to play games that much. My wife really liked it. She grew up playing card games. So Lost Cities worked for that. And it just really clicked for us. And we don't play that many games these days. Me and my wife, we play some. We play escape room games and other things, you know, that crossed my path. But in Korea, we didn't have a lot of other things going on. We only had one child at the time or two, which nowadays in retrospect, you're like, wow, so much free time. And so there was free time and we just whittled that away. So I would keep this because I'm hoping my wife survives the apocalypse with me, but it's not so much that. It's just that if something happened, I would remember those times. It's nostalgia. This one is sheer nostalgia. And I would not be where I am today without my wife. I am never envious of single people ever. I don't know how I would be who I am without her. She's fantastic and she'll never get the credit. She doesn't even want it. You know, she doesn't, you know, you talked about me going on stage. My wife hates it. You know, I ask her occasionally to be on my Q&As and stuff. And she just doesn't want to be. She doesn't want to be in the limelight. And maybe we wouldn't get along so well if she did, right? I don't know. But she's behind me 100% and I appreciate her a lot. And I don't say it enough. So that's, I'll say it by taking this game.
And so this is this is a Kanizia game and he's a sort of behemoth in the world of board gaming. And you're somebody who very much, you know, focuses on theme and theme not being pasted on, being integrated in games. Do you think Kanizia is a bad designer or a good designer when it comes to theme? And does Lost Cities fit the theme?
Oh, I don't think he's very thematic at all. I mean, with all due respect to Dr. Kanizia, he makes some fantastic games. But, you know, I've seen people write long reasons why certain of his games are thematic. And I'm thinking, wow, that feels like an awful stretch. He's a mathematician. His games are all about math. The math rises to the top. He has many, 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 many good games. He has many, 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 many bad games. But all his games are very, very much, you know, about that mathematical stuff that comes to the top. It's good. I like many of his games, but I wouldn't call them super strong in theme.
So I want to go on now and talk about your charity work. And you started the Jack Vassil Memorial Fund with a tragic event that happened in your life. How does a family cope with something so terrible happening?
Yeah, it's been 10 years now, huh? 10 years since that happened. Well, I mean, it made me grow up. You know, I was very fortunate. I go back to my early life and my parents protected me from a lot of that stuff. I went to a few funerals as a kid, but they were, in my opinion, old people, right? Old people die. That's what happens. And I was in college. My grandparents all passed away in like a period of 2 years. Like I lost all my grandparents. And even that didn't really shake me up that much. I kind of expected that they would pass away. I had a friend in college who drowned, and that shook me up to some degree. But I don't know, you know, nothing ever really hit that close to home. However, when Melody, my oldest daughter, who's 20 years old right now, when she was just a baby, she almost died. And that was a really big event for us. I mean, the fact that she had almost died, the whole event was just, it was a year's worth of time. And it was so, it sobered me so very much. People think I'm silly and crazy now, and I know I am to some degree, but I was much, much, much more so in college. And beforehand, I just was silly all the time. And that really sobered me up a little bit, like, hey, you know, this is real life. And then I had kids and we moved on and, you know, life went on. And then when Jack was born, we made a big deal about it because it was a boy. It was the first boy in the vessel. You know, it was a joke that I had only girls and I don't really care, right? It's not that big of a deal. I love having daughters. And in fact, my rule of thumb now that I tell people is if I had a son, if my first child had been a son, I would probably have one kid. But I love my daughters, but it was like, hey, boy. And even the girls were excited about that because it was something different. And so we made a big deal about it. And when I can't tell you the feeling that when my wife went to hospital, she had the baby. The baby was born 2 months early, which really was like, well, you know, I hope everything's fine. The baby was born. I went home, went to bed, and my wife called me at 2 a.m. and said that the doctor said that the baby might not make it through the night. And I can't tell you how I remember that moment so vividly. I barely know how I got to the hospital, you know, and when I got into the room, I just collapsed. And, you know, then the baby did make it through the night and we're like, all right, this is it. You know, he'll be fine. And he was in ICU for the longest time and he just was getting better and better. And the thing was though, at this point in time, I'm not really a super private guy. I don't share everything obviously, but you know, I'm on the internet a lot. So I shared what was going on and the outpouring of support that we got from the internet was just so strong and so overwhelming. And it happened around Christmas time. We got so many Christmas cards and everyone was like cheering. The baby was getting better. And then he just took a turn for the worse and he passed away in January. And oddly enough, it was a very tough thing, obviously, but it wasn't as, you know, we had already been kind of prepared for it with everything that happened to Melody, you know, 10 years beforehand. And so, you know, we sat there and the overwhelming support, and then somebody went online and raised money for us, you know, which was good because at the time I was teaching in school and I didn't have any money for a funeral, and funerals are quite expensive actually. And all these people sent in money for this and it was so overwhelming. And I said, man, what am I supposed to do? I got more money than I needed. You know, what am I supposed to do with this extra money? I felt guilty. I mean, we kind of went on a little family vacation just to get away from everything. And I said, you know what? I need to do this for other people. You know, we need to help other people in the same way, because I know what that feeling is when it happened. You feel like nobody cares. I mean, people do care. And this is, sorry, I don't mean to pontificate here, but for those of you listening, this is a life lesson that I always try to tell people is that when something bad happens to somebody, everybody comes in and everybody is there. And they say, hey, we're here for you. We're here for you. But a week later, everyone else moves on with their lives. They do. And then you're all by yourself. So remember that. Remember that person who just lost somebody. You know, you'll email them and say, I hope you're okay, or, you know, and then they're okay. remember them in a week or two afterwards because they're not getting all that from everybody else. And I thought, what can we do to help people? Because when you get this, you're just drowning. You don't know what to do. I remember when my son died and I went to the funeral home and I just didn't care. You know, my dad was with me. And so I suppose, you know, they kept talking and I was just like, I wanted to just shout at the guy to shut up. Not his fault, right? That's his job. But I didn't care what the plot looked like and, you know, and what the casket and to not have to worry about the financial part of that sort of thing was great. I didn't have to deal with that. And I thought maybe we can help other people with that. So that's what we do now. We collect that money. And if someone has something happen, you know, their house burns down or, you know, an operation, we have an opportunity to send money to them that we've already pre-collected, you know. And so that's what we've done. And I've seen recently where the fund has been called into question and people say, well, you know, we don't see it. And I, you know, not everyone's story is mine to share. But I tell you what, I've seen what it's done for people, and it works. I mean, some people have given testimonials on the internet and stuff, and if you know, I kind of encourage them to. But you know, again, it's some people's things are private. But I see how it helps people, and I'm really glad for that. Sorry if I went off topic there.
No, that was great. And so, do you think, you know, it's specifically for gamers in need, do you think part of that thinking is that, you know, when you were in need, it was the gaming community that came to you, so you felt an obligation to give back to them?
Sure. And I also did it because, you know, you need some sort of focus. You know, we can't help everybody. It's just not possible. But this gives us a focus. And yeah, there's a strong community. This community is really strong. We're seeing it right now. During the whole coronavirus thing, the gaming community is there. For some people, it's their only community that they have right now. And so, you know, I'm glad, and I want to, the gaming community was there for me. And yes, you know, it's a very different community now 10 years later, but who cares? I want to give back.
So your next game then is one that isn't even on the shelves yet, and this is Frosthaven. Are you taking this one for purely practical reasons? Because there's just loads of content in it.
That is exactly it. And I was going to put Gloomhaven, but then I saw that several other people on this show had already put Gloomhaven. And I thought, all right, fine. I'm assuming the apocalypse will happen after Frosthaven, maybe because of Frosthaven. So the reason I would pick Frosthaven is because I haven't played it yet. And I know that if there's as much content as there is in Gloomhaven, and we know there is, then this is a game that I'll be able to play and have a lot of fun with. And if nothing else, I will be able to build a little house out of the components.
Now, is this the ultimate dungeon crawl game? I mean, there's tons of dungeon crawl games. Is this the best one that's out there?
I don't know. And that seems weird because I rank it. I mean, if you go through all my dungeon crawl games, this is number one ranked, or Gloomhaven is anyway. And folks, if you're upset that I picked Frosthaven, then just pretend I picked Gloomhaven. It's my number one on if I rank them all, but it's not necessarily a dungeon crawl. It's like a really good Euro game that also takes place in a dungeon. So, I mean, I think maybe my best dungeon experience is still probably Descent, but I like Gloomhaven better, if that makes sense. I like Gloomhaven better as a game. I like Descent better as a dungeon crawl. And I guess maybe if you really pushed me and I could take any five games, I might even take Frosthaven. I might take a set of D&D books.
And so, you know, when I got into games, Twilight Struggle was number one on the BGG Top 100 and was number one for ages. And then it was taken over by Pandemic, and now it's Gloomhaven. Do you think Gloomhaven deserves to be number one? Or is the number one on BGG just not important?
Well, it's important and not important. Okay, so it's both of those things. It's important because to say it's not important is silly. If people are going to stumble across that website, they're going to look at the top ranked games. They will. I know this because I looked at the top ranked everything I go to. My top 10 lists that we do in the Dice Tower are our most popular videos. People care about what is number one. So that is important. It's important that it's there. It means that the gamers of the world like Gloomhaven the best out of all the different games. And I think to diminish that is a bad thing. That being said, if you don't like Gloomhaven, then that's fine. It doesn't mean it's the best-selling game. It's not. It doesn't mean it's the game for you. It might not be. It's just a list. You do not have to like the best list. Like, for example, if I look at the top 10 movies of all time, there's a couple movies on there I find to be quite a bit of a snooze fest. But that doesn't mean that those movies shouldn't be on the list. They're just not for me at all. And I don't have to like everything in the top movie list. But that doesn't mean it's not important and they're still not worth talking about. So yes, it's important, but for a person on a personal level, it may not be important.
So I want to talk now about the future. So the Dice Tower at this point is completely established, but you've been doing since, you know, lockdown and Corona, you've been having the daily chats and expanding sort of what the Dice Tower does, even though they've just stopped. Is there anything new coming from the Dice Tower in the future?
Well, I mean, we're pivoting, obviously, to cater to an audience that's stuck at home. Now, I mean, we always were doing that anyway. So it's, you know, we're kind of there for that. We're doing some online cons. We did one for the Summer Spectacular. We're going to do another one in December. We're going to be doing playthroughs at Essen. We're going to be increasing our playthroughs as time goes by. I know that more of the same sounds sometimes, but I mean, I'm always trying to innovate. I'm always trying to add new things, new shows. I always try new stuff. That's one thing about Dice Tower is always like, what can we do that's new and different? What new things should we be getting involved in? Sometimes it does not succeed. I remember saying, hey, let's try this 360 degree camera thing. It's going to be the next big thing. And it was not. You know, sometimes these new ideas I try don't work, but sometimes they work spectacularly. Sometimes they work as a slow burn, like our crowd surfing show, where we talk about Kickstarter projects, did not start off very popular, but it's grown to be popular. I will push something as hard as I can and keep at it for a while. But also sometimes when I do something, I'm like, I don't even like doing that. So we're done with it. So back to what you said, what coming in the future? Well, more of the same. But we're going to also try to play more games because that's what people are looking for right now.
And so, you know, you're one of the most recognizable faces and voices in gaming. And I assume when you go to a convention, it's a nightmare trying to get across the hall. You know, how does it feel to be that sort of, you know, almost central voice in gaming?
Okay, on one hand, it's nice. Yes, use a nightmare. Again, nightmares have much worse things happening to me than getting across a crowded hall. It's fine. I like it. I like that people come up to me and are nice to me and talk to me, and that's fun. I get to meet people. I've always wanted to be around people, lots of people. This year has been a bit tough in that regard for me because I like being around a lot of people. Being the central voice, I like it. Fine. I mean, who doesn't like when people listen to them? You know, people can say they don't like it all they want. They do. You like when people listen to your opinions. Of course you do. That being said, I don't know that I like being quote unquote the central voice because the blowback on people will be like, oh, the Dice Tower is so big. The Dice Tower is this and that. I'm like, we're really small. We're a really small company. I'm repeating some of the stuff that Scott Alden said on your show recently, right? He said the same stuff. Like people look at BGG as it's a big corporation and everything. And BGG is probably three times the size of the Dice Tower, you know? And if he says he's small, which I agree he is, so are we're even more so. But because we just have a loud voice and we're a big fish in a small pond. Which is fine. It's just like, when you're number one in anything, and I'm not saying we're number one, but if people thought we were number one, that everyone else is also trying to beat you. And I don't know that I always like that.
And, you know, whether, you know, you like to admit it or not, you've had an influence on the hobby of board gaming. And when you think about sort of the influence you've had and the people, myself included, that you've sort of ushered into the hobby, how does that make you feel?
Well, that I really like. And I won't deny that. And that's the one thing I'm most proud of. I've always been very proud of the fact that there are many, many, many people right now in the board game hobby who got their start from the Dice Tower, whether it was watching our show or being on the show. You know, we have a lot of people who leave the Dice Tower and go start their own channels, their own podcasts and things like that. And people think that that bothers me. I am thrilled by that. I am glad to see people have great success and stuff. And that is neat. And I don't want to be, I'm not trying to be Simon Cowell here and taking credit for their success. Okay, I'm not. People's success is on them. They did a great job. But I'm glad that we had a small part in it. It's fun for me to be involved in that way.
So your last game then is the game you're synonymous with. And this is Cosmic Encounter. And it was number one on your list for so long. Every year it was the one thing that everyone knew that was going to be the case. What knocked it off the top?
Wow, just at that particular year, I like Gloomhaven more. You know, I also don't want to be so boring that the same thing all the time. I mean, I didn't move it because of that. Just that particular year, I like Gloomhaven better. I still love Cosmic Encounter. Like I said, I found it as a teenager, fell in love with it immediately. The reason I would bring it with me is the sheer variety of the game. It will never play the same game twice, ever. And I love variety in games. I found that I am very much cult of the new. I like new experiences. And because of that, that's why my job is so good for me. I get to play new games all the time. Always playing new games, always playing new games. I don't care if they're bad. I don't care if they're good. I do like if they're good, and I don't like if they're bad. But I still have fun with those new experiences. And so a game that consistently offers a new experience to me, whether it be Gloomhaven with its campaign or whether it be Cosmic Encounter with a different set of aliens, I love that. I love the new experience. I understand there's some familiarity, but I always want to change things up. You know, I play Hearthstone, for example, and I make my decks in Hearthstone. I'll play them for a while, and then I'm like, okay, fine. Let's make a new deck. I just want to do something new. And Cosmic Encounter gives me that new experience every single time.
Yeah, this is a game that's 43 years old. I know that because it came out the year of my birth. What keeps it so fresh?
I don't know that it's. I think it's ahead of its time. It's a decade ahead of its time. It really is. People, you know, if I'm making a list of Hall of Fame games, Cosmic Encounter goes in automatically. Some people hate it. I get it. I understand why some people hate it, but you cannot deny how important this game is to gaming in general. Cosmic is just a big deal. It influenced Magic the Gathering, which I think has had a bigger influence on gaming, for sure. But its grandfather was Cosmic Encounter. And Cosmic Encounter is just a game that, because the game is about the people more than the mechanisms, it lasts for the same reason that Werewolf will probably last 20 years from now, because Werewolf is about people, not the game itself. Cosmic Encounter does that same thing.
So you can only play with two aliens for the rest of your life. Which two are you picking?
Is there? I would pick the plant, I guess, because they could copy other aliens. I would pick ones that let me copy other aliens. You know, because again, that's I just don't like being the same thing all the time. If you force me to play two aliens the rest of my life, I'd pick, you know, probably I like the humans and I like the masochists, but I would get bored playing them all the time. Then I would stop playing Cosmic. Actually, if I had to play only two aliens the rest of my life, I would be done with Cosmic.
I could handle playing. Is it called Filch, the alien where you get to steal other people's cards?
You get to take the card off the top of the pile. Yeah.
Yeah. That one I could live with. So I've got one more question then. You're driving out to the cabin, 88 miles an hour. You go around a corner. The back door flies open. Four of the games fly out of the car, down a ravine, into a river, and are swept away to posterity. Which game do you hope is sitting on the backseat of the car?
I guess Cosmic. I would make sure my wife was there probably first. And then, you know, other important things. I don't know, probably Cosmic. I like Cosmic a lot. It has a lot of nostalgia. It's the game I've played the longest in my life that I'm still consistently playing now. I've had a lot of great experiences with it. And I don't know, it's time to teach the people of the future Cosmic Encounter. Cosmic Encounter Vassal Edition. Because again, I've assumed that I'm going to be starting up the only board game company. We'll be whittling sticks and stuff, and I'll be selling them. We'll be bartering it for food, of course. But I'll be teaching gaming as a general rule of thumb after I've established my tyrannical dictatorship over a small area in Florida where I'm in charge, and I'm going to force everyone to play games. When you come in, we will sit you down. We'll play a game of Cosmic because we still have that there. We will watch your reactions and we will judge you. And if you look like a jerk, then we'll be like, I'm sorry, you're not good enough. Get back outside the walls. We only allow good people in here who can work with others.
So
I may have put too much thought into this apocalypse scenario.
No, it sounds perfect. We need a dictator in the compound. So I'm sure everyone who listens to this knows it already, but if people want to get hold of you, see what you're up to, what's coming out next with the Dice Tower, how would they go about doing that?
Oh, easy enough. You just go to dicetower.com or search us on YouTube. If you put in a board game, any board game that's ever been made, and you want to know if there's a review on it, you could type in the name of that board game and then the word Dice Tower, and there's a good chance we reviewed it.
Brilliant. Well, Tom Vassal, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate this podcast. It's a fantastic show, and I'm glad you let me come on board.
You can support the show in many ways. You can tell your friends, you can talk about it on social media, you can talk about it on your own blog, podcast, or video, or you can support it directly by going to patreon.com/5G4D for a rolling donation, or for a one-off donation, hitting the PayPal link at the bottom of the website, 5gamesfordoomsday.com. It's these donations that keeps the show going. Also, if you want to say something nice about the show, or if you want to say something horrible about the show, you can contact me on Twitter at 5GamesForDoomsday, or send me an email at 5GamesForDoomsday@gmail.com. And if I've dashed nimbly away from the cats that want to eat my face and any form of responsibility, I'll see you in 2 weeks for another 5 Games for Doomsday.